Go on, treat yourself to something.
Subscribe to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on your generic podcast resource.
You deserve it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Blackshaw Arts Hour. You're here with me, Ellie, and of course the wonderful Matt Boothman.
Hello.
Hello. Today we are doing the usual review excitement. We also have Strat and Alex doing an art excitement. And then we're also going to be talking about an exciting new podcast coming up in your ears that's in association with us, but not us, because it's actually by Matt Boothman.
Hey.
It's so exciting.
I do things other than this.
Yes. You do lots of things like showering, making breakfast.
I've done all those things today.
Good job.
I'm a powerhouse.
We are adulting so hard. And I'm going to be talking about one of my favourite things, television.
Yay, we haven't done a huge amount of TV on the podcast before.
Which is why I'm bringing you a huge amount of TV on the podcast. So we're going to start where we always start with this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good I put my trousers back on.
In a shock twist, exactly what I said I would review on the last show, which is Blade Runner 2049.
I'm going to gracefully pass out upon the floor like a lady off of the past.
So this is the sequel to Blade Runner from many, many, many years and many, many, many different cuts and versions ago.
Yeah.
Which starred Harrison Ford, directed by Ridley Scott. This one stars Ryan Gosling and is directed by Denis Villeneuve, whose work I enjoyed very much in a previous review of Arrival.
Did they direct Arrival?
Yep.
Oh.
Yes, he did indeed, with Amy Adams, another science fictional piece with what strikes me about Villeneuve's style from just those two examples. He's directed other stuff as well. He did a movie called Prisoners with Jake Gyllenhaal, but these are the only two I've seen. And what strikes me is that he seems very good at directing quite isolated people reaching out and trying to communicate and form connections.
Cool.
I feel like there's a parallel a little bit between Amy Adams's character in Arrival and Ryan Gosling's character Officer K in Blade Runner 2049. You've seen this as well, right?
I have, yes. And I hadn't thought about that, but I completely agree.
Cool. So here is a big difference between the original Blade Runner and this one.
This one is easier to watch.
Potentially. Easier to watch in what way?
Well, I rewatched the original. I watched the final cut version a few days before I went to see the new one. And I think I must have seen it kind of as quite a young person, and it had bit washed over me a little bit because it does that. So watching it again as an adult, I was like, oh man, this is slow. It's very slow. And there are some kind of its time things, like everyone's smoking all the time. And then spoilers for this very old film, the scene where he kind of gets together with Rebecca.
Well, Rachel.
Rachel,
yeah.
Sorry. Is full of consent issues.
Yeah. So the original Blade Runner, as well as being a product of its time in a lot of ways, is a film that is very about ambiguity, and it can be interpreted in lots of different ways. And that's one of the reasons that all the different versions of the different cuts have arrived, because I think the theatrical cut had quite hammering on your head sort of voiceover that took away a lot of the ambiguity, especially around the central question that people have been debating for many years about whether Harrison Ford's character Rick Deckard is a replicant or not. So replicants, this is a future where humanity exists alongside replicants who are androids, who are created beings, who have basically been created to be stronger and faster than humans.
The jobs we don't want.
To go and do the jobs that we don't want, especially to forge off-world colonies. So off-world colonization is happening, but the story is very located on Earth with all the people who are left behind because either they're too poor or too not socially mobile enough to move to these nice new colonies. There's no ambiguity at all in this one about who is a replicant and who isn't.
Yeah.
Partly because there's a time gap between the two films, in the meantime, a new oligarch type CEO type character has taken over the company that makes replicants,
yeah,
and has changed the production process so that they're much more obedient and much less likely to go off the rails like Roy Batty did in the first one.
Yeah.
And much more easy to identify, it seems. There doesn't... people always seem to be able to tell who's a replicant, yeah, and who isn't in this one.
Yeah.
So the fact that Ryan Gosling, the main character, Officer K, is a replicant and not a baseline human...
Not a spoiler.
...is not a spoiler because it's revealed very, very, very early on, basically, in the first scene. So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
It also takes away, in a way, the ambiguity of the first film by confirming,
yeah,
that Rick Deckard is a replicant. But I think you can probably, if you enjoy the ambiguity of the first film, you can probably still watch that in isolation, and you can disregard 2049 as canon if you want to, if it helps you.
I think I missed this entirely. He's definitely confirmed as being a replicant.
Yeah.
Why? How did? How, when? I didn't get that.
Oh, no. Oh, maybe. I mean, now that you mention it, maybe it's not. Maybe that's just the way I interpreted
was that what,
it.
At what point was it that you thought that was confirmed?
Okay. We'll circle back round to that.
Okay.
So this new CEO person who's taken over Tyrell Corp, who makes replicants, his name is Nyander Wallace. He's played by Jared Leto, and he's bought out the contract to create slave people, and he's made them even more obedient. Given all of those things, what do you think were the odds that he wasn't going to be an enormous creep?
Yeah, the odds are so low. Solo, you know, he's a total super duper creep.
Yeah, and again, the shades of the same sort of PR stuff as we got for Suicide Squad. They didn't go quite as hard with it this time. Suicide Squad, where he played the Joker, they made so much of the publicity around that film about how method he'd
gone. So method. What did he do this time? Blind himself?
Yeah, so like he got into character as the Joker and he played pranks on people, and then all of the publicity was about how method he went, and then he was in it for about 8 minutes.
And was rubbish.
And for this one, they didn't make quite such a big thing about it, but he definitely sort of turned up to the first rehearsal with his blinding contacts in, leaning on a retainer to try and get fully into the experience of being a blind man.
Yeah, sure.
And there were things from the director and fellow cast members saying they were really impressed with how much he committed. Again, he's in three scenes in a nearly 3 hour long movie.
So yes, it is a long film.
Yeah. And it's slow, again. You said the first Blade Runner is a slow film. This is a slow film as well, but it didn't feel like it was slow because it's dragging. It's slow because it takes its time and it's quite languorous.
It could easily be much shorter and still get the storyline across. I think because my bum got numb about three quarters through and it got to that point where it was a little bit painful, I was like, oh, this is so indulgent. They could have made this much shorter and my bottom would not be as sore right now. But actually, I think I didn't get really bored at any point like I did with the original. Sorry. Partly, I think, because of the colour palette.
Yeah.
I know that sounds crazy, but the original is so dark, like literally dark, like you're wearing really dark sunglasses the entire time, that it's actually kind of quite hard to keep engaged and keep watching. Whereas this one, it has a very orangey colour palette, which is somehow much easier to keep watching.
This one takes us much more... we see a lot more of the world in 2049.
Yeah.
The first Blade Runner, I haven't seen it in a while, but correct me if I'm wrong.
It's
mostly
in
set in the city. It's pretty much entirely set in cities,
yeah,
which are... I mean, we see one of the cities from the sky quite early on in this one, and it's basically... It appears at first to be a flat plain until you see that it is crisscrossed by these tiny... very, very thin streets.
They're like ridges,
that
really,
we then
rather
zoom
than,
down into, almost like these very, very thin canyons. So it's very dark and very neon-drenched in the cities.
It's oppressive.
But in this one, we get out of the city a bit and we start to see some of the landscape, these endless vistas of solar-panelled landscape, these enormous rubbish dumps.
Yeah.
And there's that very orangey bit, which was teased right from the very first teaser trailer.
Mm-hmm.
That very, very bright, almost fiery orange colour palette is for an irradiated Las Vegas, which we spend some time in.
It's super cool. I think that's my favourite setting.
Yeah. And that's something that Denis Villeneuve really... brings to it. He's not a workmanlike director in any sense. Like he has a very strong sense of aesthetic. He has a very strong sense of what he wants the screen to look like at any given time, and the feeling that he wants. You know, you said it sounds silly to talk about color palette, so I've got the word color palette written down in my notes here as well, like as an example of the sort of thing that Villeneuve clearly thinks about and gets exercised about with his films.
Yeah.
He's one of these every frame a painting type directors. Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to the goings on of the film. So giant creep Jared Leto, Nyander Wallace, is concerned that he can't manufacture enough replicants to fulfill demand and to help humanity spread out into the stars at the rate that he would be satisfied with. So he's obsessed with making them self-replicating, which, despite the name replicants, they weren't in the first place. And some of his minions, the aforementioned scary right-hand replicant, Love, played by Sylvia Hoeks, gets wind that a case that Ryan Gosling's Officer K is investigating may hold the key to this breakthrough. And that case also ends up linking back into the events of the first Blade Runner. And so we have a noir detective mystery going on into the underbelly of society and the secrets hidden there. I thought Ryan Gosling in it is very convincingly vulnerable.
Yes.
I thought that was the thing I was surprised about from it.
I wanted to give him a cuddle a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And not a naughty cuddle, like a very motherly cuddle.
Yeah, he's very good in it at the lore of the setting is not the replicants because they are created beings. They're not. That doesn't mean that they're unemotional.
Mm.
But he's supernaturally calm a lot of the time when under fire, when being attacked, when things are popping off all around. He keeps his calm very well, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't show emotion and doesn't show pain and
which is the big
vulnerability.
Moralistic thread running through all of these is you know, creating replicants that are so close to human, where is the line? And I know that's kind of the main thing in the first film, really, is who is which. But I actually felt it more in this film because it just seemed more pertinent to all the goings on, really. I don't want to go into too many spoilers, but
I think they add an extra very interesting wrinkle to that theme with the addition of non-physical AI as well. So Officer K's his house Siri.
Yeah.
Joy, played by Ana de Armas.
She is so beautiful.
he clearly thinks so too. There is a romance going on between the two of them. She's effectively a personal assistant a la Siri or sort of Alexa, but a hologram.
My Alexa just woke up behind Matt. Yes.
No. and he is a created being who is basically just being used as labor by the police, by the LAPD. And yet they have a real connection that is believable to us in the audience. This is where we start getting into the stuff that is wrong with the movie, which I have to say didn't affect my enjoyment of it while I was watching, but I also have to acknowledge that is because I am a white dude.
Okay.
And it's the kind of issue that doesn't affect me personally, but I became aware seeing commentary around the film from people of other genders, other ethnic backgrounds after watching the film, that it is an issue that we're talking about those cityscapes. They're very that aesthetic of far future urban sprawl and cyberpunk is really very heavily influenced by Japanese art, and artists like sort of the more well-known ones over here would be people like Shiro Masamune, who did Akira, or Oshi Mamoru, who did the original Ghost in the Shell, which got remade with Scarlett Johansson this year. And so those cityscapes are pulling very heavily from that cultural background, and yet I don't think there's a single Asian person in the movie.
No, there are no in the original in the first film. There's Asian stall holders.
Yeah. But certainly no significant speaking parts.
Definitely. Oh, what about the detective partner man?
In the first one.
Yeah.
I have not seen it recently enough to comment.
Okay, but no, I mean, yeah. Really, there's no significant roles played yeah. by anyone that's not white.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a...
In both films.
In both films, yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of African-American men, one of whom is a cop and one of whom is basically a slumlord sweatshop owner. So, light and shade, I guess.
Literally.
But the shade of that I will comment on is one of the ways that I've seen this expressed with regard to gender particularly is there's only one human woman in the film.
Yeah, the police lady.
Yeah, which is Robin Wright's character.
Who she's
is
very good.
The police lieutenant.
Lieutenant Joshy.
Yeah, who is Officer K's boss. I react against that qualification of there's only one
human
part for a woman.
Because all the actors are human.
Well, all the actors are human, and also because I feel like it misses the point of the themes of the
yes.
of the story,
yeah.
which is that we are focusing on these characters who are replicants, who are AI, who are created beings, but the whole point is that they are still fully fleshed out people with feelings and people with stories. So
yeah, so it's not like it's a lesser part to play, is
exactly,
it?
Yeah.
If anything, it's probably more challenging.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the overall commentary around how white the film is very valid.
Mm.
And I don't know whether this was something that occurred to you, the fact that there are actually quite a lot of the major parts are for women. So Joy is quite a large part.
Yeah.
Love is a very large mm-hmm. part. Robin Wright's character is in it less, but is still quite significant.
Yeah, she's a powerful character.
Some of the sort of resistance leaders and things like that,
yeah.
And sort of the contact that brings Officer K into the resistance, all, mm-hmm. all women, but the fact that the way all of those characters are treated and sort of the yeah. end that they end up with mm-hmm. is sort of there is a noticeable theme.
Yeah, well, both Love and Joy were literally created by men for men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly saying something.
Yeah.
About gender roles.
Yeah, and Love particularly, I found her quite interesting because she's someone who's, the way I sort of interpreted, because she introduces herself as Love, and then the only time we ever really hear anybody else use her name is Jared Leto's character using it, but it doesn't sound like he uses it as a name.
No,
it sounds
like
he's using it as a sexist epithet.
Yeah.
And so she's taken this dehumanizing sexist epithet and made her whole identity out of it.
Mm.
And all her loyalty to him comes out of that
mm-hmm.
and wanting to impress him and be the best of his creations. It all comes out of that, which makes her a formidable foe. But it still means that she's forged her whole identity out of the disrespect that is given to her by an enormous creep.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one explanation is that all of the minorities have gone off-world, I guess.
Yeah, sure. I mean, considering that you have to be rich and well-placed to go off-world, that seems less likely.
Yeah. So, just to circle back to the point about who is a replicant and whether Rick Deckard is or not.
Mm.
So, my interpretation was... that he must be because the whole plot hinges on whether replicants can reproduce or not,
right.
And the replicant offspring in question is his,
yeah,
which I figured makes him one,
I thought maybe it was that you needed the crossing of species, as it were,
okay,
so that you had to have a human partner and a replicant partner to make life. And I think the reason I read it that way is because I was logicking that replicants in the first film have a lifespan limit of 4 years, and Harrison is still alive in the second film many years later, and he's aged, which I didn't think replicants would do.
That is a good point. Hey, this film has more ambiguity than I gave it credit for.
But also, I mean, he could be an experiment in the same way that Rachel was in the first film. She was an experiment in terms of they created her and then implanted false memories and didn't tell her that she was a replicant. So they could have done the same thing to him.
Yeah, and there are very satisfying plot points in 2049 that revolve around the implantation of memories as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. Because that becomes the norm to create replicants with a backstory, because apparently it makes them less likely to go nuts against humans.
Pretty much. And I appreciated that it doesn't take the very obvious plot routes as well to sort of resolve. Once we set up this question of there is a self-replicated replicant offspring out there somewhere.
A messiah.
There is a sort of a very obvious feeling Hollywood outcome for that to then resolve with. And I appreciate, this is almost a spoiler, I appreciate that it doesn't go down that route.
It's twisty.
Yeah, it twists further in exactly the opposite way to Mother, which we talked about on the last show.
Which twisted into a horrible archetype.
Yeah, where I was sitting in... So for both, I was sitting in the seat... sort of mentally begging the filmmakers retroactively not to have done a certain thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Mother, I then had to go, oh no, you did do the thing. Yeah. And in the case of Blade Runner, I was very satisfied when they revealed that they had not gone down that path.
Not done the thing. Yeah. Hooray.
Yeah. So it is a long watch, but I found it
absolutely
kind of gripping, enthralling. Mm-hmm.
You think about so many different things.
Yeah, it has a really good, in the same way as Arrival did, it has a great balance of those big science fictional themes in the case of Arrival around communication, in the case of 2049 around what is personhood, what is selfhood, mm-hmm. who gets to consider themselves a person and who doesn't, what actually separates those things. Robin Wright's character makes, you know, it is kind of the voice of that theme. Mm-hmm. She basically voices the fact that it's only because society has decided that these two things are not alike.
Yeah, and it's the idea of a soul.
Yeah,
and having a soul.
Yeah, it's only because it's expedient for society to consider replicants not people that they are considered not people.
Yeah.
And it balances those big science fictional themes with some genuinely emotionally affecting storylines about that human connection.
Yes, which makes it not preachy. I think the thing is, like, you don't really think about the big ethical questions until after the film. You're not necessarily thinking it as you go along, because you're thinking in terms of the characters that you're invested in. And that's the kind of film with a message that I enjoy, is one where you're not feeling like you're being shouted at throughout the film. And it's really interesting because, you know, it does bring up all those things about gender, about race, about the environment. Like, it's huge, huge to do with the environment in terms of all the settings. And all that stuff is kind of layered in. It's not one... The one obvious thing is the people, not people question. But you've got all these other things layered in, which makes it really kind of rich.
Yeah, and it is visually beautiful to boot. And I really want Ryan Gosling's coat, if anybody knows where I can buy one of those.
Someone else said that to me. I can't remember who it was. It's a good coat. Although they do describe it as green, and I was like, it's not that green. Like the man in the green coat. And I was like, has he checked? No, he's wearing, it's almost like a dark blue. It's not really green.
Yeah, or like dark grey. Maybe it was the lighting.
Maybe. Anywho.
Yeah.
So yeah, recommend, but I would say wear some comfy bum covering. take a cushion or something. Take a painkiller beforehand.
Good, yeah.
Good.
That's what I've got to say about that.
Excellent. All right. Well, next up, we're going to be listening to a little bit of Strat and Alex doing some art. Today's art task for Strat and Alex is going to be finger painting.
Finger painting.
The
finest of all of the art forms.
Art form.
So your challenge today is going to be somewhat historical. Matt, tell us what we're going to get them to do.
You're going to finger paint the Titanic.
Oh man. Okay.
So you can interpret that as you see fit.
Yeah.
Right.
But you only have 10 minutes.
10 minutes to finger paint the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
Are you excited to get like properly hands on with the art?
I'm looking forward to it, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Tactile with the art.
Tactile mixed the art.
With the art. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just as a heads up, are we allowed to sort of like spread it and mix it on the paint with a paint, or do we want like splodgy finger paint?
As long as you're using just your fingers.
Cool. Okay.
So you can't use your entire hand. Your fingers.
Oh, okay.
The Titanic looks exactly like a print of my hand, though, so can't I just
convenient.
Do that?
So you can use whatever technique you can devise, really, as long as you're just using paint and your fingers. Does that sound fair?
Yeah.
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 Any further rules you'd like to impose, Matt?
No, I think extra rules at the 11th hour would be unfair.
Cruel and unnatural. okay, so the Titanic, interpret as you will. 10 minutes.
It's going to be such a mess.
It's going to be a horror show.
Fingers and paint only. I do have baby wipes on hand.
Okay, good.
So you've got 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And your time starts now. Okay, so we'll check back in a bit to see how the boys get on with that challenge. In the meantime, Matt, tell us all about your podcast.
You mean this podcast that we're on now, the Blackshore Arts Hour?
No, I don't. I mean your other new one.
Oh yeah, because this is your podcast, really.
Well, it's Blackshore the podcast, okay. And we are associatedly involved in what is very much your podcast.
Yeah, so on Friday, 27th of October, the feed goes up for a new podcast called Merely Role Players, which is a Shakespeare reference.
And Do you get it?
which is where the Blackshore gang get together and...
We sound like the Famous Five.
Maybe we'll do one where you're like the Famous Five.
Oh, yes, please. I genuinely listen to the Famous Five audiobooks when I have trouble sleeping. So good.
Basically, we get the Blackshore gang around the table and we play role-playing games where all of the gang play themselves, but in various weird settings and genres. So... Mm. The first mini season, which starts on 27th of October, is going to be a ghost story.
Ooh.
Very much starting off in my comfort zone,
mm.
Where the gang roll up in a spooky West End theatre and discover strange goings on, and we see how they react to that.
See, now we sound like the Scooby Gang.
Yeah, a little bit.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I get vibes of that from I'm in the middle of editing it as we record this, and I'm definitely getting vibes of that, especially as I've just, this is a small spoiler, recorded the bit where Alex trips over his own feet and falls down the trapdoor in the stage.
Classic Alex. What an idiot.
So the first adventure is with Ellie, Vicky, Alex and Strat, all of whom you've heard on the Blackshore Arts Hour before.
Yeah, so don't worry, there won't be any stranger danger in years.
From that point on, it's a short season of 4 or 5 episodes where they go through this adventure of a ghost story, and it'll pick up after that with another genre, which may be a Famous Five adventure, or it'll be a Christmas story to be seasonal. We don't know because we haven't recorded it yet. But it'll be very exciting. You can get that from... there'll be links on my website, which is mjstarling.com. That is my alter ego for when I'm doing creative stuff. Will there be links on the Blackshore channels, Ellie?
Hell yeah, there will. Yeah,
so if you follow Blackshore, you'll be able to pick it up there. It's also going to have you can follow the podcast itself on Twitter at merely roleplay. There weren't enough characters for that.
No,
whole
we
name.
Have that problem with Blackshore. It has to be Blackshore Update rather than Blackshore Theatre.
Yeah, and there is a Facebook page which you can find by searching for merely role players.
I'm going to sign up to all of these things as soon as we finish recording.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear my own voice. We had so much fun recording it. I'm sure that will translate in the listening to it. And there's also bonus episodes, which will be released alongside each real episode as well.
Yeah, so the main episodes are going to be the actual story of each adventure and me describing what's going on and the guys telling me how they respond to that. And then I was rolling some dice to see how well they do and whether they fall down a trapdoor or not. And then there'll be bonus episodes in between the main episodes where we go a bit more behind the scenes, backstage, in terms of how the game works. And you'll get to see how all of the players have filled in their character sheets and worked out what their stats for all the dice rolling and things are.
Yeah, so basically, if you don't have a background in Dungeons and Dragons, which I don't and neither does Vicky, then it's a learning experience. And so... you should listen to the podcasts with these bonus episodes, and then you will absolutely be starting from square one, as Vicky and I were. Whereas Alex and Strat and Matt have all played sort of conventional Dungeons and Dragons type games before. So this is different, obviously, because it's more... it's off-road storytelling, but it's got dices.
It's a lot simpler in terms of rules than Dungeons and Dragons. You only need one side. You only need one kind of dice.
Yes.
Your character sheets are much smaller than a massive, detailed Dungeons and Dragons sheet.
Generally
like less dice rolling and much more just improvised collaborative storytelling.
Yeah, it was. It's so much fun. You must all listen.
And I've decided that it is theatre.
Anybody
who thinks otherwise can fight me.
Well, he's thrown down the challenge, so you'll all have to listen. And if any of you want to fight Matt Boothman, you can tweet us. You can tweet him directly at Matt Boothman, or you can get in touch with us at Blackshot Update, and we'll set that up.
Good. I look forward to it.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll all be listening to that from the 27th of October.
Yep.
Okay, so we're going to just check back in with the boys now and see how they did with their finger painting challenge. So after what I would call an intense 10 minutes,
Jesus,
you guys have produced individual works of art, your own interpretations of the Titanic.
Oh, I thought you meant our interpretations of works of art.
I mean, both could be applicable.
Yep. So, Matt, do you want to talk us through one of them?
So I'm not a visual art critic by any means. So good.
And nor am I a visual artist in any.
But you're good at painting. You paint though, right?
So these are my paints.
I think it's really good.
Yeah. So like what I can say for contrast, obviously, if you're listening along, go to our social media and you can see them as we're talking about them. One contrast is what Alex has done. He's created himself a frame and painted within it, whereas Strat has taken his canvas and has painted kind of across it and left areas of the canvas in their natural brown paper state.
Yep.
Whereas Alex has created a frame and made sure that he's filled it entirely with paint.
Yeah, filled with paint is definitely the word for it.
Hmm.
And what we seem to have in Alex's is that, like, the prow of the Titanic emerging from between pieces of the iceberg. Is that what we're going for?
Yeah. I think that's fair enough.
I wasn't sure if they were the iceberg or sort of pitching waves.
Ooh.
I was about to say emerging from like in a trough between waves, and then I saw that they were white and remembered what happened to the Titanic.
you did a remembering.
So in many ways, it's really conjured the spirit of the tragedy for me.
Yes, good.
Well,
I mean, it's very recognisable as a big ship. You've got the blue and the red and the white, and you've got some yellow to denote portholes. Mm. So and the big sort of funnels at the top.
Yeah, very noticeable funnels.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say about that is I was kind of annoyed that I didn't leave myself enough room for the famous fourth funnel on the Titanic.
Oh.
Because that pretty much is a key indicator that it is the Titanic.
But it does look like it could just be hiding behind the iceberg or wave there.
Yeah, and that's very helpfully what Strat said. It's just hiding behind the iceberg, isn't it? And I said, well, yes. Yes, it is.
I quite like the almost optimism in this as well, because it looks like it's going to go through. It looks like maybe the artist
thought
it'll
be okay.
It'll be all right. But we as the audience know it's not going to be all right.
No. I mean, there's the dramatic irony.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
All intentional, of course.
I think you've done really well in creating sort of the movement of sea. And I mean, it's clear that it's a ship and it's the sea.
Yeah, good. And there's been lots of blending of the colours
as
well, especially in the background.
Just the way you've made the frame, because the reason mine is not like that is because I, even given brushes and time, it would just become a mess. So I'm in awe.
Oh, thank you very much.
It's a boat. It's a boat. Mine would not be a boat.
Well, let's have a look at yours, Strat. Can you hold up your work?
Alex displays something about the feeling of the of the thing. Oh, by the way, there's a splodge blue circle at the top left of mine. Please ignore it. I was trying to clean my finger.
Right, okay. That's not the sun, then.
That's not the sun, no. In fact, I'll hold it with my hands. Okay. Anyway,
so you can't see it.
So there you go, Matt, yeah. If you want
to... In many ways, you've incorporated techniques that you learned from the comic drawing task. In that we have a speech bubble.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, with a swear in it.
I thought it was appropriate.
It says shit.
Yep.
So, I mean, what I like is that yours is really telling a story. There's the boat is almost entirely, in fact, submerged.
Yep.
It's only got one funnel showing.
Yeah.
It's brown, which is an interesting choice.
yeah, it didn't start... Yeah, the colours got a bit wonky.
That's fine, maybe it got muddy. Yeah. And then you've got a little lifeboat, which again is brown.
Well, they were wooden, weren't they?
No.
Weren't they? The Titanic ones are wooden. I'm sure they're wooden.
Yeah, but they're all white,
though. Oh, well, anyway, they're wearing orange life jackets.
Sure.
Which they definitely had back then.
And they have big blobby heads.
Yep.
That's good.
And again, we've got colour blending, especially in the iceberg.
Yes, the iceberg looks really good and cold.
Yeah, and texture coming into the waves, mm-hmm. So it's not just a blue morass.
I can see definite crests.
Yeah.
I think it is, again. I think actually, you know, it may be even clearer in Strats that it's the Titanic sinking, or definitely a boat sinking.
When we revealed the brief that you needed to paint the Titanic, Strat,
yes.
Did you immediately hit on the idea of drawing it half sunk so you had to draw less of it?
Yep. Or... I can't paint no boat.
I didn't even think of that.
Let alone a boat that looks like the Titanic.
So hide as much of it as possible.
Yeah. Exactly. I thought, I don't know what the Titanic looks like. Like, if I was told, what does the Titanic look like? Even if I looked at it, I'd think, well, maybe now you've done the funnels, I'd remember. Mm. But I thought, what does everyone know about the Titanic? That it
sank.
It sank.
Yes.
So if I do a sinking big boat,
then they'll with an iceberg.
With an iceberg next to it.
That is a well-known technique that a lot of artists use. I remember being at primary school and an artist who illustrates children's books came to the school and explained that he couldn't draw camels. So he just drew the behind of a camel.
Oh, right, okay.
Because he couldn't draw the face. Yeah. He was like, I'm really bad at it. So I knew he was really bad at it, so I hid it. Whoa. And we were all like, really? And he was like, yep. I was like, amazing.
He's an honest artist.
Yeah.
So I hid most of the ship.
Yeah. It's good. Well, clearly good artist technique.
Yeah.
So for me, on the judgment side of things, I feel like because Strats doesn't have a background other than the brown paper, that loses him some points in my mind.
Mm-hmm. I am leaning pretty much in the same direction. Partly because of, as we said... The context in Alex's case is slightly less clear.
Mm.
So Strats, we've definitely got the story of the iceberg and the ship is sinking.
Mm. Mm.
And you can tell it's the Titanic that way. I think it speaks well of Alex's technique that you can tell it's the Titanic even though it's not sinking.
Not mid-sink.
Oh, Alex would win. Like, I will also vote for Alex. What's happened here, right? It looks as though sort of like an adult... who is a painter is like been in their studio painting,
right?
And then their child
yep.
has come in and gone, Daddy, can I paint with you? And Daddy's gone, yes, but you have to use your fingers, and I'm going to keep doing it like an adult. And we have the result here.
Okay.
This is how I feel about it.
I mean, I think considering you've both been painting with your fingers, you've both presented very high quality pieces.
I don't know how Alex
it's
painted.
very gracious of you, Strat.
No, yeah. Like his looks like that is like the style of painting in which he wants to paint, because like kind of a blobby impressionist kind of
it's very clear brush strokes. Starry Night, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. Have I just been linked with Van Gogh?
Yes.
Yours
looks like an artist did it on purpose.
Yeah.
I look like I did it with my fingers.
Isn't that often the way? Great. Well, I mean, congratulations to you both, but I think on this occasion, Alex is the winner.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's been great fun.
Okay. Have an extra point. Well, that was lovely.
something so pure and wholesome about finger painting, even if it is painting a huge tragedy.
Yes, the 1912 tragedy, the sinking of the Titanic. We're going to be putting, obviously, pictures of the process and the finished products, which are now in my bin.
Ellie.
I left them on my dining table for ages, and then I was like, "Oh, I don't. My fridge is behind a cupboard door, so I can't even like put it on the fridge. Like I have weird overgrown children." So after a while, I did just decide that they could go.
It's all right. They're immortalized in pixels now.
Yes, absolutely. So we'll be uploading them across all our channels, and you can judge for yourselves whether whether Alex was truly a worthy winner.
Yeah.
I think he was.
Yeah.
Right, so now is when I get to chat about one of my favourite things ever. We're going to be talking about some television.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's right. And Matt doesn't think he's heard of a lot of the things that I'm going to be talking about.
Because I basically only have Netflix. I don't have normal channels at home.
Yeah, so I have normal channels and I have Netflix and I have Amazon Prime. And I sometimes go around Vicky and Dave's house when they're not in just to watch Now TV.
They let you do that, right? Yes. They know that you're doing that?
Yeah, usually. Yeah, I have a key. I went there, right? I was there last night. They've gone to Wales for the weekend. I was there till 1:30 in the morning watching Chicago Fire. It's the best.
That's how much Ellie loves TV, everyone. These recommendations are going to be fire.
She will break into your house and watch the channels she does not have.
She didn't break into their house.
No, I
disclaimer,
didn't.
Don't come and arrest Ellie.
It's fine. I had both permission and keys. So some of these recommendations that are coming up are things that I've found on the internet that sound great and I want to watch, but they've currently only just started airing in America, which means that they probably won't be viewable over here unless you have super duper fancy channels, which I don't have. But I reckon they're all prime candidates for appearing on Netflix or Amazon Prime in the near future.
So this is your TV preview.
It is. It is that. But obviously, if you're in America or you have magic powers, then you may have started watching these things already. So the first is called The Good Doctor. As far as I know, it's nothing to do with The Good Wife, which was a very good series. But this is essentially very different.
Because they did do a Good Wife spin-off,
yes,
that
they
was
are.
The good something else, or did they?
Yeah, no, they are doing a spin-off, and it's basically the same, but without the character of Alicia Flockhart.
Oh, right, okay.
Flockhart?
Florrick. You're thinking of Callista Flockhart.
I am!
Anyway, sorry, this is happening because I've distracted you from the thing you're actually talking about.
I prepared notes and everything, and Matt is just totally ruining it. This must be what it feels like when you're doing a film review, and I just ask weird stuff. Yeah.
No comment.
So, Good Doctor is about Dr. Sean Murphy, who's played by Freddie Highmore, who we all love. He plays a young surgeon who has autism and savant syndrome, and he's just got a job at a fancy San Jose hospital. But
what?
As he travels there, he encounters an accident at the airport that requires his unique expertise, and simultaneously, mm-hmm. his benefactor, the president of the hospital, has to fight with the board about keeping Sean on board as a doctor, because they're a bit like, what? He's autistic? I don't know if we want an autistic doctor.
They sound like the baddies.
They do at the moment, yes. And it's created by the same guy, David Shaw, who created House.
Ooh.
So he knows his medical dramas.
He does.
I was going to say potatoes, but he knows his medical dramas. So it started at the end of September on ABC in America. So I'm hoping it will appear here soon. And I'm excited because I love me a medical drama, and I think Freddie Highmore's really good, and I loved House, so it's ticking a lot of boxes.
It's got a lot of things going for it.
It does. Similarly, SEAL Team, right? This is starring David Boreanaz.
He's still around.
Yes, he's been in TV for more than 20 years.
What?
He started as Angel in Buffy in 1997.
Obf.
And I think if anything, he is aging like a fine wine. That man is even more attractive now than he was back then, which is saying something. So I loved him in Bones, which finished at the beginning of this year, I think. And now he's head of a SEAL team, which isn't that far off, I would guess, from his Bones character, where he was a military man and then FBI agent. So he's suffering from PTSD, having lost a friend and colleague in a botched mission. So he's already brooding, which is, as we know, David Boreanaz's speciality. If he's not brooding, he's not David. And his intense job has already cost him his marriage, as well as damaging his relationships with his three teenage children.
Oh,
I know.
I'm getting shades of Tim Roth's character in Lie to Me,
yes,
very slightly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So in Bones, David Boreanaz was ex Special Forces, and in SEAL Team, he's current Special Forces.
Yeah.
Is there a David Boreanaz extended movie universe?
Maybe
happening.
Maybe.
Is this a prequel to Bones?
It can't. Well, it can't be. In terms of the children, because in Bones he has a young son from a previous relationship.
Okay, and also I guess he looks older in this.
Yes. So maybe this is like a split universe situation.
Maybe.
But I would give this a go purely for David Boreanaz, because he is always really good fun. And it sounds like a kind of procedural crime situation that is very much in my wheelhouse. So I'm going to give that a go. Again, it started at the end of September, so it's already happening in America on CBS. So, again, something I'm going to try and hunt down. Then we've got Ghosted. So, alongside procedural crime dramas and medical dramas, I'm big into the supernatural.
Yep. With you on that.
Yep. So this is a disgraced cop and a bookstore clerk played by Adam Scott, who is one of my most favourite comedy actors ever. He's best known, I think, probably as Ben on Parks and Rec.
Yeah.
So they're brought together by a shadowy government agency to investigate paranormal activity. One's a skeptic, one's a believer. Ah!
It's the X-Files. Except they're both dudes.
Yes. And it's supposed to be very funny, and they're 22-minute long episodes, so nice and easy.
I do always like to have an American 22-minute comedy sitcom,
yeah,
on the go.
It's a good filler.
Yeah, yeah. And when you've only got a few minutes.
Yeah, and if you need like a palate cleanser after some kind of hard, heavy-hitting, drama-y thing.
Yeah.
So that started the beginning of October on Fox. So that's Ghosted. So that's on my list. Then we've got Wisdom of the Crowd, which started on the beginning of October on CBS. Now, this is kind of not new ground in terms of the concept, really. So the idea is that a year after the murder of his daughter, so obviously tragic setup, billionaire tech genius Jeffrey Tanner, played by Jeremy Piven, who I love, he's great, creates Sophie, a crowdsourced crime-solving app designed with the sole purpose of finding the person who killed his kid. And then somewhat predictably, information pours in and leads to the potential solving of lots of crimes, not just, or probably not at all, the death of his child. Because I think if they solved her murder, then the series would finish, right? So it becomes clear to everyone involved that this app has the potential to revolutionise crime solving. So again, procedural crime drama, but this kind of thing I think has come up in programmes before.
It's reminding me a little bit of Person of Interest.
Yes.
Which was, that was AI rather than crowdsourcing, but still like a crime-solving, crime-stopping, predicting bot
yes.
thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Which was Ace. So
yeah.
If that's going to be the comparison, this is going to have to do well.
Yeah. So I'm hopeful for this. Then we've got this. So there's a ton of kind of X-Men stuff coming up.
I love me some X-Men.
Yeah. Now, apparently, is it the League of something on Sky?
Are you talking about one that's bad?
Yes.
The Inhumans is
yes,
supposed to be very, very bad.
Which is a shame, because it's got some people I like in it, but it's supposed to be really terrible.
Yeah, Ewan Rayon's in it, isn't
exactly.
he?
Exactly.
He's good, but apparently he can't save it.
Oh, if he can't, I don't think anyone can. Well, I'm hoping that this is going to be the antidote to that. This is called The Gifted. It started at the beginning of October on Fox. It's basically X-Men, the show. So you have two parents, played by Stephen Moyer off of True Blood, who I always forget is British, because he's all like, oh, suck it. And Amy
it's like
Acker.
He's in the room.
I know, right? Amy Acker, who was also an angel and Person of Interest.
Yeah.
So they find out that their two teenage children have mutant superpowers. One of them can blow stuff up, and the other one can create force fields out of air and water. Pretty cool powers.
Interesting.
So America hates mutants, and like they're out to kill them. And surprise, surprise, the dad is working for a task force who is there to clean up the mutants.
It's like the Claire Bennett part of Heroes.
Yes, exactly. So obviously he kind of has an in to protect them in that sense, but it makes things also more dangerous. And yeah, so basically they accidentally reveal their powers at various points and chaos ensues. So it sounds kind of formulaic, but I'm interested on the basis of my fan status for X-Men and also for Amy Acker and for Stephen Moyer.
The first 10 minutes of the first episode are actually up on YouTube.
Ooh.
Even if you're not in the America.
Good knowledge, Boothman. Okay, I'll look for that and post a link.
Yeah, the storyline you're talking about there with the family doesn't actually come into that clip.
Is it like more overarching?
It's overarching. Like there seems to be like there's some mutant resistance stuff going on in parallel, which will presumably dovetail at some point.
Okay.
But that's what that clip focuses on.
All right. I'll get that all loaded up for the blog when we post it. So there's more, guys. I mean, I really love TV. My final kind of big American show recommendation to explore is SWAT.
Okay.
Now, this is a reimagining of the 70s TV show and 2003 film of the same name.
I remember enjoying the 2003 film of the same name.
Great.
But I would have been, what, like a teenager then?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that means it's good or not.
I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be very similar to that or not. I imagine it's probably not that similar to the 70s TV show. It's the reason I think this piqued my interest is that it's particularly exploring the strained relationship between police officers and the black community in America. So I think it's got potential to be really interesting and kind of walking a difficult line. Also, it stars Shamar Moore, who was one of the leads in Criminal Minds, which is one of my fave procedural crime dramas, and he left that last year. So to see him in another show is going to be very exciting. He's a beautiful, strong man. and basically from the pilot, he leads the SWAT team, and he's instantly asked, are you black or are you blue?
Ooh.
So I think that kind of that conversation is going to be interesting, and it does say in some blurbs I've read that this is kind of the beginning of them investigating a series of racially motivated crimes that may or may not be connected. So I think it's kind of going like balls out on the
balls to the wall,
yeah, on the kind of racial situation. I mean, that's not a phrase. I'm just TV tired now. So
but you're still going.
I'm still going.
There's more.
So that's on CBS, and it doesn't actually start until the 2nd of November. So I'm wondering if things tend to go that they show them in America, and then the season finishes, and then it goes straight onto UK Netflix.
Yeah.
That seems to a lot of the time be the cycle. So I'm hoping that's going to be the case, and we'll be seeing a lot of these in the new year. Okay, so this is one I think you're going to be excited for.
Okay.
This is Alias Grace, which is a Netflix series, and it's based on the book written by Margaret Atwood.
Ooh. I like her.
Yes, Margaret Atwood, off of writing the very well-known Handmaid's Tale with the very successful adaptation this year. So this is a very different story. It's based on a true story, which is of a woman called Grace, who in the 1840s was convicted of killing her mistress, master of the house. She was a maid. Like of brutally murdering them, and she was in prison for 30 years, and then her conviction was overturned and she was released. So Margaret Atwood takes some liberties in that she inserts a character who's a psychologist who goes into the prison to see, because he has an inkling she might be innocent,
mm-hmm.
and she claims amnesia, so he wants to investigate whether she truly has amnesia and if he can help bring her memories back through hypnosis. So it's really interesting. There's a lot of kind of disturbed chronology and flashbacks to like the event and pre the event, and all the time it's ambiguous as to whether she is guilty or innocent. So I'm going to put a link up that's got a trailer,
okay,
which looks great. It's got some really good people in it. It's been directed and produced by Sarah Polley, who's done a bunch of stuff that's pretty good, and she's wanted to do this production since she was 17. When she was 17, she applied for the rights to do the film.
Wow.
And was turned down. And now she's producing a full Netflix series of it, which is pretty exciting. It is airing in Canada in late September, but it'll be on Netflix 3rd of November. That's soon. I'm excited. And it's got, also off of True Blood, Anna Paquin.
Oh, yes. Also, who's been in Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams recently on Channel 4.
Yes, I haven't watched that. I watched a bit of it and got a bit scared. And it's got Edward Holcroft, who was fantastic in London Spy with Ben Whishaw, and was also in the very silly Kingsman movies as the posh baddie. So I've been talking for quite a long time about television, but I will quickly recommend a few things that I have actually seen. So this is not just looking forward. This is actual proof of watching. Liar, which was on ITV. It's an incredible series that starts off being a pretty straightforward he said, she said over a rape accusation, but turns out to be much more complicated than that. It's written by the Williams brothers, so Harry Williams and Jack Williams, who also wrote the other thing I'm recommending, which is Relic, which was on BBC One and has just finished. Relic is about a series of murders, but you view them backwards. So kind of in the style of Memento, it starts with a section of footage, which is, seems to be them catching a killer. And then it suddenly says 24 hours earlier and like loops back. And then you see a section of activity from that time period. And sometimes it's a jump of like an hour. Sometimes it's like a day or longer. And it goes back to almost like 8 weeks before the ending has happened.
So does it, because I haven't watched this yet, does it have, like Memento had, sort of an in story reason for telling the story like that, or is it just kind of, we thought it would be interesting to tell a murder story this way?
I think it's just that it was interesting, and I don't think it's been done like that before.
No.
It must have been incredibly complicated to put together, and of course because it's backwards you're given all sorts of what turn out to be red herrings. And also, like, people's motivations aren't very clear. So Vicky and I watched it together, and there was a lot of back and forth about, what's happening? Why did that man do that thing?
And then I guess you find out two episodes later why that man did that thing.
Exactly. Okay. And it's and often,
why that man is going to do that thing.
Yes. And quite often you think you know something, and then it goes backwards and you go, oh, no, it's a totally different thing to what I thought. And there are some very big reveal moments which made us shout at the TV. So I would definitely recommend that. So
that's satisfying.
Yeah, very satisfying. The first episode I wasn't convinced because there's a lot of exposition to get through, but it's really, really good. So that's only six episodes long, and I think Liar is as well. Yeah, but they're both six episodes long. They're both written by the Williams brothers, and you can watch both of them on the ITV and BBC catch-up services at the moment. So I would highly recommend people do that. And there are some more stuff going on Netflix, but I think I'll save that for another day.
Okay.
So, you full of TV ideas right now?
Full of TV ideas, and so I have to add those all to the list of things I'm looking forward to, along with the new series of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
When's that starting?
Which is, well, it's on in the States at the moment.
Oh, so it should be on Netflix.
I keep very annoyingly seeing people who live in the States tweeting about it or posting about it on Tumblr.
Isn't it usually on E4?
It'll be on E4 probably in the new year is how they usually schedule it.
Okay. Ugh.
And yeah. I mean, if you've never watched Brooklyn Nine-Nine, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah, get on Netflix right now because all of them are on Netflix and it's so much fun.
I think it's probably one of the best sitcoms ever made.
Yeah, it's incredible. Right, well, you've got lots of homework, everybody. Start watching. If you watch or are going to watch any of those things or have watched those things, please let me know. I love talking about TV. Get in touch and let me know what your thoughts are and we can have a good old TV chat. Okay, well, we will be back again with you in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, keep on artsing. Is that what we say?
It can be.
Okay. Keep on artsing. Bye.
Go on.
Treat yourself to something.
Subscribe to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on your generic podcast resource.
You deserve it.